pulses Black Wall Street. The new excavation comes after the city's decision to expand the search in September, after an excavation attempt this summer found no human remains. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 74 degrees and mostly sunny. In New York City, it's 68 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering. Please stay safe.
The time now is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio. Listeners, I'm your host, Milton Alamadi. And today we're going to be looking into a crisis. We're going to be trying to answer the question, why out of the total of about a million doctors in the United States, only 6% are African-American or people of African ancestry? And our guest to help walk us through this is Osose Obo. She's a fourth and final year student at medical school, Michigan State University. She's also the president of Student National Medical Association. She will tell us a little bit about what the association does. So let's welcome on to the show, Osose Obo. Welcome to Black Star News Show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Milton. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well, let's start off. First of all, why Michigan State, a cold place? Did you not have a chance to go to a warm environment to study medicine?
I was actually looking for a change. I'm originally from California, and I was not very appreciative of having 75 degree weather all day, every day. So a lot of the programs that I applied to were all in the Northeast and Midwest area. So Michigan State ended up being a great fit. One, because that was one of the programs that my sister and I, we were both applying at the same time. It was one of the programs that we both got into. So, of course, wanted to stay with my older sister to get through medical school together. But two, Michigan State also had a very specific program that was of interest to me. I wanted to have the opportunity to live and train in Flint, Michigan. I'm very passionate about public health and understanding what it takes to live through a crisis and understand the importance of knowing your community resources so that you can continue to connect your patients to them. And so when I was applying, it was still the Flint water crisis was a pretty popular topic. And they have a program where you can go and train there for your third and fourth year. So you're doing all your hospital clinical kind of work there. So we got accepted first to Michigan State, and then we got accepted to that special program. So it was a pretty easy choice.
Okay, very good. All right, so tell listeners, first of all, how old were you when you decided that I want to be a doctor?
You know, I'm Nigerian, so I will say my parents were really trying to push that into our heads at a young age.
Before you could even walk?
Before we could walk. Ah, for sure, before we could walk. They were talking about either doctor, lawyer, engineer. Those were the three options. Everything else was nonsense. But I think that the age at which I fully committed and realized that this was a calling and not something that I felt my parents were pushing on to me or what have you, I was probably around 19 when I was sure.
Okay. Now tell us, in case there's some young listeners out there who want to also are considering, have not decided yet whether it should be medicine or not, what are some of the things that they should really make sure before they make that decision at an early age?
Yeah, I would say it's important to get exposure. And I think that's something that's a little bit difficult for students of color, being that we don't have as many doctors as we should have in this country that look like us, right? So I think one, ruling out other fields of study, I think is super important. I tried to make sure that I kept a somewhat open mind to other areas, whether it was engineering or tech, or one, I'm very interested in photography. Photography could have been a full-time job, but I had to make sure that I ruled out things to be sure that this sacrifice, because going into medicine is a sacrifice, is a lot of time and energy that it takes to serve people in this way. But I had to definitely make sure that this was where I was supposed to be and the way that I could best give back to my community at large. So definitely explore as much as you can.
And you still do a lot of photography. I saw on your social media page, you take some professional looking photographs. And how do you even find the time for that? But the bigger thing is, it also proves that you really don't have to be a quote unquote nerd to be in the hard sciences.
Oh, definitely. I would say I'm a nerd, though. You have to, but and I think being a nerd is cool. It's kind of like you enjoy learning. So I enjoy learning about photography. I enjoy learning about mentorship and how to best connect with people, how to teach folks and new topics, and that's like in medicine. So being a nerd and enjoying learning can pour over to anything. And so when it comes to photography, I'm a professional photographer. I've been a professional photographer for about 10 years now. And it's all about balance and trying to make time for the things that are important to you. And for me, photography is one of the things that brings me joy and can help to refill my cup. And I think that's important to make sure that you're prioritizing those things, especially when you're in such a taxing career as medicine.
Okay, very good. So tell us a little bit now about the Student National Medical Association, what it does. And then after that, we can get into the discussion about this crisis of only 6% of physicians and surgeons in this country being people of African ancestry.
Yeah, so the SNMA, the Student National Medical Association, is an organization that's just near and dear to my heart. It was created almost 60 years ago to create a safe space for students of color, because at the time there was the American Medical Student Association and the American Medical Association, and they did not allow Black or honestly people of color into those groups. And so first and foremost, the National Medical Association was created for Black physicians to come together and be the voice of parity for justice in healthcare and among Black and brown populations within the US. And so the Student National Medical Association was first a part of that organization as a section to make sure that Black medical students and other medical students of color had a space where they could just dedicate time to issues that they were going through as they pursue their medical education. But we separated from the organization and became our own standalone nonprofit. And the work that we do is all towards diversifying the face of medicine. We put together programs across the nation for our thousands of members to help them be successful academically, to assist them with networking, because networking is one of the ways to get your foot in the door, even as a college student or a high school student, to do what we can to make sure that they finish school and become culturally excellent, socially conscious, and clinically excellent physicians.
Okay, so let's get into the crisis now. The COVID-19 pandemic has really exposed a lot of things. And then one of the things that, of course, we've seen many discussions about the lack of people that really look like the most afflicted communities. First of all, in terms of the impact, the adverse impact of the pandemic, we've seen how disproportionate it's been, particularly in the Black community. And we've also exposed the lack of people in the healthcare profession, doctors and other healthcare practitioners that actually reflect and look like people in those communities. And that is why I thought it was interesting to have you today to walk us through this. Why is it that after all these years, only 6% of surgeons and physicians in this country are Black? What are the main obstacles, and why have we not been able to overcome these obstacles?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's such a timely topic, especially as we're living in a pandemic that is disproportionately affecting communities of color. And so I think there's several reasons. Medicine is, for the pursuit of a career in medicine as a physician, is one for those that are wealthy. It's still a field that thrives off of keeping people out. And that's as early as applying. Just the cost to apply, the cost to take the entrance exam to be able to apply are insane. I know now the MCAT is the test, is almost $400. The preparation to study for the MCAT, to buy those materials, the companies that are the best and that are best able to train students to take that test, which is actually a really stupid test, is like $1,000. So already it's a financial barrier to students of color that come from homes and families with lower socioeconomic status. And so first and foremost, that's the main barrier. Two, students are being discouraged at an earlier age from coming into this field. They are pushed towards other kind of blue collar jobs, which are also equally important, but they are not encouraged as much as their white or majority counterparts, which is another problem. There's a problem with the pipeline. And so those are things that honestly, that the Student National Medical Association kind of works to address by trying to figure out how do we get scholarships into our communities to help with the cost barriers? How do we educate kids from as early as elementary school to know that, look, you can make it. You can go into medicine. You can become a doctor. So those are kind of the things that we're working on. And I think those are two of the biggest obstacles that we have. We can't even get in the door.
All right. So if let's say parents or young people wanted to get some information in terms of that would provide encouragement, but also that would lead them toward resources, possible financial help to cover the cost of even these tests or scholarships, right. Where should they start? Where do they go?
I would say they can start with us. They can start with the Student National Medical Association. We are such a widely connected organization, especially because we have 10 regions, right? And so each region has access to its own network of Black doctors and organizations that are providing scholarships for students. And so by getting connected with the Student National Medical Association, we can at least, if not provide them with the scholarship applications from things that we got going on ourselves, we can at least point them in the right direction to resources within their region.
Now, I understand in the past, there was an attempt to have a positive affirmative action plan in all of these schools to have them commit at least to recruiting 10% from the African-American community. I understand that plan has not worked out so well, and that in some cases, the 10% was used to include other communities, not necessarily people of African ancestry. Is there any sort of a mandated program that is still in the works or that's being discussed?
No. And that's, I think that's something that maybe this pandemic will bring to light as far as the need. That's honestly a very important question. There are a lot of schools that are working to at least create like early assurance programs mm-hmm. with historically Black colleges and universities so that at least there's a pipeline from HBCUs to specific medical schools. And I think something that's important to note, if we look historically, there was a report called the Flexner Report that was used to decrease the amount of Black physicians in this country.
Because with that report, to increase, to decrease or increase?
To decrease.
How did you spell that report again?
Flexner. It's Flexner.
And what was the whole, give us some background. What was the whole?
Right. So the report was created, was done in order to evaluate medical schools, specifically HBCU medical schools, mm-hmm. to see whether or not they were actually training competent physicians. Mm-hmm. And it was done, of course, by a white male. Mm-hmm. And because of that report, all but four HBCU medical schools were shut down. And so now I think I saw it recently on social media that someone did the math that if those other schools had not been shut down, almost, I think maybe it might be 100,000 black physicians would have been in practice in the U.S. today. So it's a very important report to, I think, to look at and to see like what the actual impact of it was. And that the report itself was based and founded in this systemic racism that we are seeing play out now in our communities and the police brutality that we're seeing and so on and so forth. So it's important to understand the history of this country and how it has led to this crisis that we're seeing in this lack of diversity in medicine today.
And who financed that report? And what was the whole genesis behind it? I mean, I don't imagine people just, some folks just woke up one day and said, listen, let's do this report. I mean, it's so preposterous, you know?
It's definitely preposterous. I will say that I am not sure who found or who funded the report. It was done by Dr. Abraham Flexner. He published these findings as far back as 1910 that it was done to provide the criteria to standardize and improve medical schools. But really the main goal was that it forced the closure of so many HBCUs.
Okay, because obviously somebody saw a trend and they saw the shifting demographics. They started seeing more doctors of African ancestry, and somebody didn't like it and said, this is one way to maintain white supremacy. That is so interesting. Listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, and I am your host, Milton Alimadi. Our guest is Osorse Obo, and she is a fourth-year medical student at Michigan State University, and she's trying to walk us through the crises. I've been asking her about why only 6% of physicians and surgeons in this country are of African ancestry. Listeners, you know you can only get this kind of program on WBAI because we are commercial-free. We are supported by listeners such as you. So I should remind you at this point to pick up the phone and dial 516-620-3602 and make a donation that will be put to very good use to WBAI. Or you can even do something better. You can become a buddy. You can select a program, and I hope, of course, Black Star News Show is one of your favorite ones on WBAI, and you can become a buddy, in which case the money is taken every month out of your credit or your debit card. You can do that by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. So we appreciate your support, listeners. And now back to our guest. So a friend of mine who is a retired doctor told me to ask you, when I told him I was going to be interviewing you on this show, that do you have a mentor? Because he says mentoring is also very important to be a successful person in the medical profession.
Oh, I have so many mentors, so many great mentors. I will say it didn't start out that way. When I was in college, I definitely had no mentorship, and it showed. It showed in my ability to succeed and to properly navigate the pre-medical journey. And so once I graduated, I think that's when, one, I met my first Black doctor and found actually the Association of Black Women Physicians, which is based in Los Angeles. And that was where I finally got a taste of what it looked like to have a mentor that was invested in you. And I definitely credit them with a lot of my success today. And then, of course, being a part of the SNMA, I wasn't president from the beginning, you know what I mean? I was just a member in the beginning, and they had so many conferences that were also local as well as national, where you got to meet so many other Black med students and physicians that were happy to take you under their wing. So definitely have my mentor squad and always looking to add to it.
And does SMA, does the association, do you do like traveling conferences? Do you go to other cities, New York, Washington? Go ahead.
So we have 10 regions, right? And so each of those regions have their own regional conference. Now, pre-pandemic, of course, we could travel and come together and be a part in that powerful space, as well as our huge national conference, which is honestly that was the largest of its kind, that brought together Black and Brown students from across the nation, almost like 3,000 students, to come together to learn how to navigate the path to medicine. But now, of course, because pandemic, all of our regional conferences, which are occurring this fall, are virtual. And so if folks want to get plugged in and attend, all they'd have to do is visit our website at snma.org.
Okay. And in terms of the annual conferences that pre-pandemic, are those held in different cities every year, or is it the same location?
Yeah, it travels based on our members. So our members get to tell the national board what cities they would like to see us in, because the goal is to try to bounce around to the different regions so that we kind of share the weight in travel as the years go on. And so they give us a couple options, and we go and scout and pick some sites for years to come.
Okay. Now, in terms of this is probably a very hard question to even figure out. Where do most medical students of African ancestry come from? Is there a way to tell which cities or which region?
Yeah.
Which high school?
Okay. Well, I can't tell you high school and such specifically, but I know where the majority of them attend. A majority of them are in the Northeast area. So our region 6, which is like, it's like the DMV area, New York, that's where I think a lot of our, that's region 6 and region 9. That's where a lot of our membership comes from. Just across the Eastern coast. Far less African-American students are on the West Coast than in Central.
So we obviously need to work in those zones.
Definitely. But I mean, if we look at the populations of African Americans within the country, a lot of the majorly populated cities tend to be on the eastern side and in the south. So it makes sense that a lot more African American students are in those areas as well.
Right. Are some schools doing a better job than others in terms of creating an accommodating environment for young Black students, making resources much more available? And if you do know, could you maybe list a few of these schools offhand if you know?
I will say I'm not an expert in that. I mean, for sure, the schools that are graduating the most Black students are the HBCUs. That's Howard, Meharry, Morehouse, and Charles Drew UCLA program out in California. Right. But I will say just off of, There are schools that definitely prioritize diversity and prioritize looking at applications holistically, which I think is also important in matriculating a diverse class. I will say that Michigan State has historically been better about that. Mm-hmm. I think the class right under me, I think we had at least 30 Black students that came into our class. And I remember seeing them and just getting teary-eyed by seeing so many Black students in one class, and specifically in a predominantly white institution. So there are schools across the nation that are working to prioritize that for sure.
Okay, and if there's anything else that you were in a position to do, if you had absolute power to make things better, what are some of the things that you would do to improve this situation?
Well, first and foremost, I would lower the costs. Mm-hmm. I think more students of color, more Black students would apply if the financial burden to apply to medical school was cheaper. Mm-hmm. From the testing to the actual application, I think my application was at least $1,000 outside of having to travel for interviews, which is a whole nother cost. Right. And so if I could do anything, I mean, I would love to decrease that financial burden, because I think that alone is a, such a huge deterrent for Black students to apply in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And if some very wealthy people, and there are quite a few in New York as well, if there's some wealthy folks listening to this interview and wanted to do something financially, could they work with your association, and how would they do that?
Oh, definitely. We've had a huge uptick in interest as we've grown on social media. But if you have any desire to diversify the face of medicine, the SNMA is the organization that you should support. We have a donation link up on our page. If there is something specific that you would like your money to go towards, you can always email us, of course. My email is open. But we are honestly, it's the work that we do. We are happy to be the doorway for you all to help relieve the burden, the financial burden on our students. So please, you feel free to email me. It's president@snma.org, and I can get you connected.
Okay, that's the question I was going to ask, actually. So any final words from you?
I will just say that there's a lot going on in the world today, but there's also a lot of things that we can be grateful for right now. And I want to make sure that the listeners out there know that as far as the Black medical students that are in school goes, we are grateful to be here. And we know that we're going to be the change for the next generation. And so I myself am grateful to be here, ready to graduate in about 6 to 7 months and join the physician workforce. And I just want to thank you, Milton, for giving the SNMA your radio show as a platform to share the work that we're doing. So thank you for having me.
And where will we see Dr. Obo practicing? Or is that undetermined?
It's undetermined. We're all waiting to find out.
Yeah, I know. You send out the application and then you wait for the result. You know, actually, there's one other observation I wanted to make, and you can just react to this and then we can close it out. Many years ago, my girlfriend at the time had just finished her residency. And now, in fact, no, it was during her residency in a New York hospital. And she went and examined a young girl, African-American. And she noticed she was tense throughout the examination. And then she asked the young lady, the young girl, what is wrong, dear? And she told her, I want to see a real doctor. And this is somebody who's about 6 years old and could not believe that she was a doctor because she was not white. Have you heard of incidents like this anywhere else before?
The only response that I've ever had from African Americans so far, kids, teenagers, adults, was that of awe and pride.
You know what? That to me is like, yes, that things have changed a lot. So perhaps we are edging toward a better direction. So on that note, thank you so much for being on the show. And we hope to have you back again when you start your residency so we can celebrate that as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
sisters and brothers, welcome back to the second half hour of Black Star News Show. I am your host, Milton Alimadi. In the second half hour, our guest today is Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussein. He is a retired Ethiopian-born medical doctor, and he is the author of Made in Ethiopia. He is going to walk us through today on what's going on in Ethiopia. There was good news when Abiy Ahmed became prime minister in April 2018, and he ushered in many progressive programs in Ethiopia, liberalizing the political space. He freed political prisoners. He freed detained journalists, was promoting reconciliation within the country, and regionally moved out to make peace with longtime enemy neighboring country, Eritrea. Very promising. And last year, he was deservedly, I believe, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But there's a lot of fearful news coming out of Ethiopia nowadays. So we want Dr. Nur Hussein Mohamed to walk us through that. Welcome to Black Star News Show.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your program. I think in order to really get a sense of what we are talking about, allow me to maybe spend a couple of minutes with the Ethiopian state as it was constituted, as it's now.
Absolutely. As long as you remember the time limitation, my friend, but please.
I remember that. And yes. But what I wanted to say was, you know, just it gives you a good background.
Go ahead.
The current Ethiopian boundaries were formed by Menelik, essentially. The traditional ethnic groups in Ethiopia have been the Amhara, the Tigrayans, and the Oromos for the last 500 years, you know, alternating in governing Ethiopia. But the rest of the country in the south and the east has been under their own, they have been under their own little kingdoms and fiefdoms, paying allegiance to the emperor, to the mayor, to the Ethiopian king. But it was Menelik that brought them into the current boundaries and from a central government.
You mean Emperor Menelik the Second? For listeners Menelik that are not familiar, correct?
The hero of the Battle of Adlon. Yes. Yeah. And so that's the current Ethiopia. But I think, as I said, the three ethnic groups are the ones that have been dominating Ethiopian politics, especially for the last 500 years. And the peripheral ethnic groups have been more or less marginalized. And I think the country, of course, is very, very diverse, multi-ethnic. There are 86 languages. I'm talking about languages that are spoken in the country. So the EPRDF, or Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Forces, that fought the military regime, particularly TPLF, that led that carried the brunt of the resistance, formed this coalition, and it was dominated by TPLF from Tigray. The EPRDF government actually was responsible for the dramatic economic development that occurred for the past 27 years of their rule, making it probably one of the fastest growing economies in the world. But in the process, EPRDF was becoming increasingly authoritarian and increasingly actually corrupt towards the end of the, especially around the land area where the Oromos particularly, but also southern peoples and nationalities were being dispossessed and displaced from their traditional farming regions in favor of the large agribusiness thing. And that's a problem all over Africa, in fact, all over the world. So that led to the actually Oromo uprising in 2015, protest after protest, and the EPRDF really was unable to control that. Eventually, the EPRDF going into weeks and months of soul searching, appointed Abiy Ahmed to be the head of the EPRDF. And immediately upon assuming power, he freed all the prisoners, particularly journalists who have been in prison for a long time for being critical of the government, and also inviting political parties from both at home and abroad to participate in the political process freely. And he invited the media, also Ethiopian media that were overseas, to come home and participate without any interference from the government. And that was welcome news. It was really, and this Ethiopia at that time was under a state of emergency under the last days of EPRDF. He lifted the state of emergency. In other words, there was such an incredible jubilation in the country. I happened to be at that time. In fact, I sent a dispatch to the Black Star News at the time. Right. Yeah, it was like I have never seen, in Ethiopia before or anywhere for that matter, because they said there were like 4 million people that converged in Addis Ababa from the city and from the surrounding areas to show him their support. And soon after that, he also, without any conditions, reached out to Eritrea and established, normal relations with Eritrea, a sort of truce, a peace treaty was kind of signed. And it's for that particular move that the International Nobel Committee actually awarded him the Nobel Prize last year for bringing peace. This was a period, really, that we were looking into, full of optimism and so on. But the next year after that has been, I'm afraid to say, going downhill, frankly. So many things conspired to converge on the problems of the country. One of them is, of course, the economic development, the economic progress was stalled. And right now, actually, the economy is tanking. But more importantly, there had been ethnic tensions that the Oromos felt they had been under domination of the Amhara kings for such a long time. And now they are, of course, coming in their own. And so it was directed against the Amharas in Oromoya, essentially.
And Dr. Nur Hussain, what percentage of the population do the Amhara make? And what percentage do the Oromo make, roughly?
The Oromos are estimated to be like 35% of the population of Ethiopia, out of 110 million. And the Amharas are close second, almost like a little bit over 30%. And
is it possible that the leadership, or has this been done already, and am I asking a silly question, is it possible that the top leaderships can convene a national dialogue to arrest any possible disintegration and move toward a better direction?
That's a very good question. Actually, that's what I was coming towards the end, because I think that's the direction many are taking after the carnage over the last year or two. I think, just to give you, TPLF was the dominant party within the EPRDF, but also it represents a smaller population, though. It's only 6 million in the northern Ethiopia. It's only because they fought and brought about the change in demise of the military regime.
They defeated the military government of Mengistu Haile Mariam, correct?
Yes, exactly. And so they enjoyed, a disproportionate, portion of the power in the former EPRDF.
Right.
So there was directed also against the Tigrayans, as represented by TPLF, this uprising, both Tigrayans and Amharas. So TPLF has been a very staunch defender of the federal state. Abiy Ahmed, when he came to power, was talking about unity and reconciliation and forgiveness and so on. But the unity part of it was predicated on one country being ruled from the center. And this didn't fit well with the TPLF, but also with the Oromo Liberation Front and other minority ethnic groups, because what was guaranteed them, the autonomy, would be taken back, they felt, you know, because the federal arrangement, you know, actually was something that they want to maintain. Abiy Ahmed, instead of the APRDF, he replaced it with his own party called Prosperity Party, which was to be really open to everyone, regardless of the ethnic, belonging, and also would be a unitary government governed from the center. And this is anathema to the smaller ethnic groups and also to the Oromos particularly. Because what they have gained through the previous federal arrangement, level of autonomy, they don't want to part with it. So this so is the big question.
So there seems to be a challenge into finding a manageable balance. Is that correct?
It's finding a manageable balance, but another thing that I, unfortunately, is the role of the media. Ethiopia hasn't had a tradition of free media for a long time, and now that they are all, you know, free to function, many of these media outlets are actually broadcasting, very incite, which might be considered incitement to violence, you know. Aggravating the tensions between the various ethnic groups. If you are an Oromo, you would talk all about things about the Amharas. If you're an Amhara, you would talk about the Oromos, you know, in all negative terms and so on. So much so that they are or against the Tigrayans, or if you are from the south and Somalis and Oromos, it has become really very toxic kind of environment.
And
especially
are these
social media?
And are these media outlets owned by private individuals and by political parties and businessmen?
And mostly political parties and private individuals that started out in the U.S. and particularly in the U.S. There was an Ethiopian satellite TV here, and there was an Oromo media network, which Jawar Mohammed started, who is probably the most prominent Oromo leader who is now behind bars. We'll talk about that later, because many of these leaders have been, the tendency right now with the Abiy Ahmed government is resorting to really putting back most of the people that it doesn't agree with back in prison. There is the Oromo leaders, there are journalists now behind bars, there are, thousands of Oromos that have been put behind bars because of rioting and so on and so forth.
Dr. Nurusen, is this somehow connected as a reaction to some of the violence that we've seen, including some political assassinations? Is this why we're seeing the retrenchment of the liberal space that had been created by Prime Minister Abiy?
Yes, it is. Well, by the way, I'm glad you brought it up. There have been high profile assassinations in the country in the past 2 years. The chief of staff was assassinated in his own residence. Nobody knows as yet.
Of the National Army?
Of the National Army last year. The president of the Amhara state and his deputy were assassinated in their office in Amhara, in Bahardar. And the general that they said orchestrated all this was himself immediately killed. Nobody knows who is behind all this. So this is really a sense of uncertainty and despair has really overtaken the kind of jubilation that we saw, because I was there last January.
Short while ago. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM. New York, and I am your host, Milton Alimadi. Today, our guest is Dr. Mohammed Nur Hussain, a retired medical doctor living here in New York. He had practiced in New York for many years, and he's also the author of Made in Ethiopia. Ethiopia, as you know, had given us some very hopeful and encouraging stories since Abiy Ahmed became prime minister in 2018. But things seem to be mighty turbulent right now, and Dr. Nur Hussain is walking us through these challenges. Listeners, I want to remind you, WBAI is commercial free. And why is that? It's because we rely on the support of listeners such as yourself to bring you the type of quality programming that you're listening to now. So I need to remind you, please do pick up the phone, dial 516-620-3602, or you can go to give and then the number 2, WBAI.org, and you can become a buddy, in which case the money is taken out of your debit or credit card on a monthly basis in the name of Black Star News Show. We now go back to Dr. Nur Hussain, Mohammed, in the remaining time that we have. I would like to ask you, what about the National Army? Is that relatively integrated or is it dominated by one of the states? And how much power does the EPDRF still exert in terms of the military balance?
Okay. A very, very good question. EPRDF essentially doesn't exist, but the Prosperity Party that Abiy Ahmed established was made up of the former leaders of the regional states that formed the Prosperity Party. But a significant segment of those of the previous parties don't necessarily approve of that, and there is significant opposition, especially in Oromo. And like I said, Jawar Mohammed and a few others, the deputy chairman of the Federalist Party, Oromo Federalist Party, are behind bars. One of the most prominent political leaders, who is a moderate and who's been a staunch opponent of the previous EPRDF government, but functioned within that environment, Lidatu Ayale, well-respected, who always calls for reconciliation, has been put behind bars also. More importantly, the much-valued reconciliation between Ethiopia and Eritrea has become essentially a reconciliation of Isaias and Abiy, nothing else. Those two leaders frequently travel to each other's country unannounced, and without any, with the parliament of Ethiopia not knowing what exactly is being talked about. So that's also another area of uncertainty. Some people consider that because TPLF has essentially, severed ties with the central government in any way, and is ruling its own regional state, they feel that they are conspiring with Eritrea, which borders Tigray, that there may be an attack imminent on that region. So all kinds of speculation abound. You mentioned the National Army. That was a very professional, well-regarded army. In fact, it's also on various peacekeeping missions all over Africa, frankly. But now it has become more, tensions are brewing within the army itself. But the army by itself is not a match to the local, regional forces that are being recruited in places like Oromia and Amhara region and Somalia and so on. They have their own local armies now. That's the ominous part of it. I don't know who they are aimed at. And even some of them are tens of thousands strong, well-trained, well-equipped. And the country is awash in arms. There is a lot of arms flowing into the country. Killing has become almost occurring with a numbing frequency in many parts of the country.
Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussain, we are going to run out of time. I want you to tell listeners, based on your reading of the situation on the ground, based on your frequent visits back to your homeland, what do you see possibly happening? Give us the worst case scenario first, and then give us the best case scenario. And I'm afraid we'll run out of time in the next 3 minutes or so.
Okay.
So
the worst case scenario is a fear among all Ethiopians that the country is going to be really fragmented may not survive as such. It may be into various ethnic kind of local states. And they may be fighting, in fact. But the most immediate fear is a fighting between the TPLF forces in Tigray and the federal government, because they don't see eye to eye. There are three major problems. One is an election that should have been held in 2020, according to the constitution, has been postponed to 2021. And many feel that the current government has outlived its legitimacy. They are calling it illegitimate, and they cannot really, take measures on behalf of the country because they don't represent the constitutionally. They should have called an election.
Right.
So that's one part. And the Tigray region, in defiance of the federal government, has held its own election according, it says, as per the prescribed constitutional requirement. So it conducted an election already. TPLF has won much of that region. So there may be a confrontation between this and the federal government. That's the fear. The second part, of course, is that this happening in the midst of a COVID-19, and the big issue of the GERD, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which has really has made possibility of war conceivable with Egypt, because of no agreement being reached about the period, the duration of the time, of the filling of the dam, and so on, is hanging over the country's, a problem. So that's another big problem. The best case scenario right now, and there are increasing number of people emerging at this point, both from the Oromia region, Amhara region, and some in Tigray and some in the southern parts and so on, keep calling for a national dialogue, for a grouping of this. In fact, I wrote an opinion piece in the largest English language newspaper, Addis Fortune, calling for that myself that was in August, titled Ethiopia on the Precipice, there is still time. And so the best case scenario.
Dr. Mohamed?
Yeah.
Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussain, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I know this is something that we're going to definitely have you back on to discuss. Ethiopia is one of the countries that Africa is most proud of. Having been the only country not to have been colonized by a European country because it had defeated an invading Italian army at the Great Battle of Adwa, March 1, 1896. So all Africans and Pan-Africans wish the best for Ethiopia. You're going to have to come back to give us an update. Now, please let listeners know how they can get a copy of your book, Made in Ethiopia.
It can be obtained at the by the publisher Africa World Press / Red Sea Press, or it's also available on Amazon.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much. You've been very informative, and we'll definitely have you back. Thank you, comrades. Stay well.
Thank you, comrade. Thank you.
And listeners, remember to go to blackstarnews.com, and you can also follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. Stay well, stay Pan-African. See you next week.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. The coronavirus has now infected over 8.2 million and killed over 220,000 people in the United States, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Yesterday, more than 58,000 new cases were reported in the U.S., with 445 deaths. And globally, there have been over 40.4 million confirmed coronavirus cases and over 1.1 million deaths. Washington, D.C. reported 25 new coronavirus cases yesterday for nearly 16,400 total confirmed cases. D.C. reported no new COVID-19-related deaths, keeping total fatalities at 641. For more information and how to get tested, please visit coronavirus.dc.gov. District health officials added 8 states to the city's high-risk list, underscoring the resurgence of the pandemic in parts of the country. D.C. considers another state high risk if its 7-day average of new COVID-19 is at least 10 per 100,000 residents. Mayor Muriel Bowser has ordered any high-risk state resident on non-essential travel to D.C. to self-quarantine for 2 weeks. Those on essential travel are asked to self-monitor. The new states added to the list are Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. Maryland and Virginia remain exempt from the order. The second and final debate before the U.S. presidential election appears to be set to go forward with new rules meant to prevent candidates from talking over each other. The U.S. Commission on Presidential Debates on Monday announced a new rule on muting the microphones of President Trump and Biden to give them each 2 uninterrupted minutes at the beginning of every debate segment. The commission said the measure was put in place to enforce agreed-upon rules. Under the agreed-upon debate rules, each candidate is to have 2 minutes of uninterrupted time to make remarks at the beginning of each 15-minute segment of the debate. The final presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden will take place on Thursday at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. Nancy Pelosi's deadline for a deal on a new stimulus package expires today, but there is still no deal. Pelosi said over the weekend that a deal must be made by today for Congress to have a shot at approving the legislation before the November 3rd election. The White House announced Monday that it has increased its coronavirus relief offer to nearly $1.9 trillion. The Supreme Court on Monday refused a Republican request to block an extended period for counting ballots in Pennsylvania, allowing mail-in ballots received up to 3 days after Election Day to still be counted. With a tied vote, the court lacked a majority to side with Republicans and defaulted to a decision from the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which permitted the deadline extension. Pennsylvania is one of the 3 crucial swing states that appear to have record levels of mail-in voting this year. The state's 20 electoral votes could be decisive in the race between Biden and Trump. Trump won the state by less than 1% point in 2016. A poll worker in Memphis, Tennessee, has been fired after turning away early voters who were wearing Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe T-shirts, as reported by an election official on Monday. Tennessee law does not allow voters to wear items bearing the name of a candidate or a political party in a polling place, but state law does not prohibit statements such as Black Lives Matter, and it is not yet clear how many voters were turned away. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 75 degrees and mostly sunny. In New York City, it's 70 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering. Please stay safe.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump face off head-to-head in their last presidential debate on Thursday, October 22nd. And Pacifica Radio will have national live coverage of the debate right here on this radio station. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Pacifica Radio's Sojourner Truth. Join Gabrielle Wellner.